Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Tennis Worthy Podcast, brought to you by the International Tennis Hall of Fame. I'm Brett Haber, and we have an inspirational guest for you today. That's not to imply that Jim Courier and Ken Rosewall and Patrick Rafter weren't inspirational. They were the subjects of our first three podcasts of 2024, and please do check them out if you missed them. But our guest in this podcast had to battle against much more than the opponent on the other side of the net.
I never grew up envisioning myself playing the Paralympic Games because it wasn't on television. There was no exposure for disability sports. Sitting and play sports and play the highest level of sports is very stressful for your body and your lower back. Worrying about not losing is not the same as worrying or fighting for a win.
Esther Vergeer has been paralyzed from the waist down since the age of 8. And yet she has dealt with both the need to build a life as a disabled person and the desire to beat every opponent she ever faced as a wheelchair tennis player. She compiled a phenomenal record at every level of wheelchair tennis while remaining a genuinely humble, down-to-earth person. You might almost describe her as the Roger Federer of wheelchair tennis, albeit with a better winning percentage than Roger. Listen for yourself to this remarkable Dutch woman as she spoke on her first visit to the Hall of Fame in Newport, Rhode Island, with Blair Henley.
Well, Esther Vergeer, thank you so much for joining us on the Tennis Worthy Podcast. We have so much to discuss. I know you just got into Newport last night, but I want to start with the question we ask many of our guests, and that is, what is it that you think makes you a Hall of Famer?
Well, that's a difficult question in the sense that it's maybe weird to say about yourself, but
right.
I think that my contribution to tennis or wheelchair tennis has been in the years that I've been playing, I contributed a little bit about, you know, the development of wheelchair tennis, and it's in the way we play wheelchair tennis nowadays, in the way we see wheelchair tennis nowadays, if it comes to coverage and the awareness of disability sports maybe in general, and also the development of equipment, for example. So yeah, I've added little bits of those things in the development of wheelchair tennis.
I think you've used the word a little bit a couple of times. I think maybe it's a little more than a little bit, but absolutely, and we're going to talk a little bit more about that. But I'd love to start chronologically and go back to the beginning of your tennis career. So you had surgery on your spinal cord at age 8, and that left you paralyzed from the waist down. Started playing tennis, from what I understand, at about 12 years old.
Correct.
How old were you when you thought to yourself, okay, I maybe have a particular talent in this sport?
Well, I guess around the age of 14, when I was playing some tournaments in the Netherlands and I was watching other good wheelchair tennis players from the Netherlands, a coach came up to me and he saw me playing and he said, well, maybe you have some talent, you have good hand-eye coordination. You're a very energetic little girl who wants to learn. So these are all ingredients where you can maybe improve your game. Would you like to come train with me? And I think that was the first time someone gave me a compliment. So in the years before, I was only confused by me having a disability. I was faced with all the facts that a lot of things were more difficult, or I was slower than the rest of my friends. So this was the first time somebody gave me a compliment in how good I was at something and that I could improve. And I think that was the starting point for me to start believing in myself that I really could become better. Not even world number one. I wasn't dreaming about Paralympic Games yet, but just a compliment that I, you know, could improve in something. And that was a start for me.
That's huge for a kid that age to be complimented and to have that positive reinforcement. How much did that psychology, maybe even more so for you, given your story, how much did that play into your drive to eventually be this incredible record-breaking champion?
Yeah, it's been an important aspect of, I think, the fact that you want to improve yourself every single day. The fact that he gave me that compliment that day on tennis was making me starting to believe in myself again as a little girl. As, you know, I was okay to be there. I was okay to be part of
school, that it was okay to be part of a sporting team at my school. And I think that's important, that you tell yourself every single day that you're part of society, that you're part of who you want to be part of, and that you can be whatever you want to be. And if this is a girl that, you know, is going to be independent, that's when I started to believe that I could be independent, not relying on my parents all the time, or that I was able to live the life that I wanted to live, just like anyone else, going to study whatever I want, become whatever I want. And I think that is important as a kid growing up.
In those junior years, was there anything that made you doubt your pursuit in tennis? Were there any setbacks that made you doubt your ability or what was possible for you?
Well, in the beginning, I wasn't even dreaming about Paralympic Games, because I never grew up envisioning myself playing the Paralympic Games, because it wasn't on television. It wasn't showed, it wasn't aired, it wasn't, there was no exposure for disability sports. And so I was doubting myself in a maybe more regular way or normal way, that sometimes during training sessions, I just didn't have my day and I was like, well, I should give it up because it's not going to work. And I mean, I have fun, but it's not going to go anywhere. Or maybe I was playing basketball at the time. Maybe I should, you know, just play basketball and stop playing tennis. Or after I lost matches, that I was just didn't believe in myself anymore. But then at the end, in a couple of years, I started to win a couple of tournaments. And people were telling me all the time that I had talent and I could be, you know, maybe potentially a Paralympian. And then I started to get more interested in those types of, you know, goals to set myself. And I realized that whenever I set a goal like that, or I told myself to have a goal like that, then all of a sudden you want to work harder. Then all of a sudden you see that you need more than just a tennis training, but you see that you need more experts around you and you need more expertise. And that's the fun part of developing yourself as an athlete, to see that you can add all those little things to become a better athlete.
So it sounds like you had the physical gifts, the hand-eye, the ability to strike the ball well. That perhaps maybe came more naturally to you than it came to others. Were there aspects of your mental game, though, maybe when you talked to your parents about when you were little, that there were hints that you were perhaps more driven, more focused, more competitive than the average child?
Yeah, I was a competitive girl. I grew up having an older brother, and he was teasing me all the time, and I had to fight, you know, my place in our family. And he was, we were just talking about it actually, but he was teasing me all the time. When I just became paralyzed and was in a wheelchair, he was teasing me, and he would run up the stairs and he would just laugh at me. But like,
wow.
Like brothers,
yeah,
and sisters do.
Oh, sure, I have two brothers.
Yeah, so and that's good, and I think that's what, you know, formed me or shaped me in a way that I wasn't scared of
criticism from others.
Yeah.
Yeah,
because I was used to that. And mm-hmm. I think that shaped me and made me that I wanted to fight and never give up. And so I could use that in my sporting career as well.
I love that. So yeah. Did you thank your brother?
maybe I should do that again.
There you go. Yeah. You can save that for your Hall of Fame speech. I want to read off some numbers. So you, of course, know these, but 44 major titles, 169 titles in all, 7 Paralympic gold medals from March 2001 until when you retired in 2013. You only lost 1 singles match. Absolutely incredible numbers. And of course, you finished your career on a 470 match winning streak. I think when so many of us think of sports and how they build character, we think of how they can teach us to handle losses. You didn't have many of those, but you have spoken so many times about how tennis built your character. Can you tell us how that was built for you, given your incredible success?
Yeah, and in a way, a lot of people say that, you know, from losses you will get stronger mentally and physically, and you will learn, and it'll teach you a lot of stuff. But I think winning games, winning matches will, you know, teaches you a lot as well.
Sure.
And I also had setbacks, of course, in injuries or in training sessions, and I had my losses in doubles. So I know what it's like, and I also see that if you want to become the best, you have to work hard. If you want to stay the best, you have to work hard. And if you don't, well, maybe it's weird that I'm going to say it, but if you don't care about winning or losing, you have to work hard as well. And that's what I did, I think. So I had a streak up until, I don't know, match 300. I don't know the year. I don't know the exact number.
It's hard to keep track once the numbers get into the hundreds.
But then eventually I was more worried about losing and losing the streak. And that's when I realized that I don't like playing tennis that way. And so that's when I started to invest more in mental training, because I hated that feeling. And that was not the reason why I started playing tennis, because worrying about not losing is not the same as worrying or fighting for a win. And so I wanted to get rid of that feeling. So I invested more in mental training, and I think I became mentally very stable. And that's also why I could continue that streak, because I never was, there was no real highs or lows or in my mental state. And I was happy when I won, and I could enjoy it, but it never took me off guard to any direction. And also during matches, I wasn't really easily to disconnect from my path, so to speak. But that's all because I invested a lot of time in those mental training sessions and you know, the breathing exercises and preparation and imagination or visualization and all those things. And I think that's also the part that I loved about tennis, because there's so many aspects in this game, and there's so many aspects that you can improve yourself on and focus on and develop. And especially maybe in wheelchair tennis, where when I started, it was a sport that just begun. And now, of course, we have evolved over the years, but that means that you can make big steps and make sure that you continue to grow as a person and as an athlete and as a sport, and all those aspects of growing. I loved putting my energy in that, and especially when you see yourself grow and become a stronger person. And actually, I love the fact that, and I guess, I never asked my opponents, but I can imagine a little bit that, you know, the opponents that I played, whenever they saw that they were, you know, facing me in the draw, that I already had like a 3-love advance on them. And yeah,
the Novak Djokovic, the Roger Federer, the effect. Yeah,
yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah, and that played part of it as well.
Could throw Serena Williams in there as well. It's just those legendary figures in our sport. And I'm sure at the time you don't necessarily maybe want to think of yourself that way, but absolutely it has a psychological effect. And because you mentioned the mental training, you were ahead of your time. You retired in 2013, and really it wasn't until maybe the past decade where players started to really talk openly about employing sports psychologists. Why did you decide to do that? Did you have somebody on staff? What was that arrangement for you?
I guess I was always looking for a next or different aspect of the game that I could improve, because that would keep me motivated. And so maybe I was already one of the fastest on court. I had good mobility. I was also one of the few women's athletes that could hit the ball that hard. So all those aspects I already had developed. And I just realized that brain and body is connected in a way that we do not understand as a human being yet, or not fully. But I was aware that it has a connection, because whenever I'm nervous, something happens with my arm, or something happens with my pushing the chair. And I didn't want that to happen anymore. So I knew that it had to do with my brain and my mental state. So I was just curious. I was just curious how that would work in general, and how that would work for me.
Can you give us an example of whether it was a breathing technique or something that you would visualize before a match or a routine that you had that helped you avoid your arm feeling a little funny or not being able to push the way that you wanted to? Is there anything that comes to mind when you think back?
Well, there's one, of course, there's a lot of things, and I think the breathing exercises is a totally different aspect than visualization, mm-hmm. for example. What I tell, you know, the next generation athletes is to sometimes just keep it simple because tennis is already a complicated sport.
That's for sure.
And then, I was unbeaten for so long, and there was, in every match, there was this moment that I would become nervous. So it wouldn't matter if I was up 6-2, 4-2. There would be a time within a match that I would become nervous. And that's, of course, an emotion that mm-hmm. comes up. And there was a time that I was trying to fight that emotion and, you know, getting frustrated that it would come up, or angry at myself and tell myself not to feel that emotion. And then the mental coach, he said, well, there is no way that you can fight that emotion. You just have to let it be there, and you know that it's going to come. So whenever you feel that it's coming, you have to embrace it and feel that it's there, and then have to distract yourself from that emotion so it would go away and have your focus on your game plan again. So for me, it was an easy tool, but whenever I would feel that emotion, I would give myself a very easy exercise, an easy task to do. For example, the next 10 forehands, I have to hit it, cross court deep, or I would make a placement of the ball. And I would do that, and I would have distracted myself from, you know, the emotion, and then I could focus back on my plan again. So those little exercises or tasks would help me to, yeah, get back on track, basically.
I love that. I feel like I might use that in my day-to-day life.
Yeah, and again, it sounds so simple, but sometimes that's what you need on a court when the pressure's on, when circumstances are not complete in your control, and then sometimes you need just a simple task.
Yeah, absolutely. It does seem simple, but yeah. I think letting it happen is the most important part, because we do tend to fight it.
Yeah.
I want to switch gears just a little bit. Sven Groeneveld is going to be doing your welcome speech this weekend, and we can't wait to hear it. He coached you for the last 4 years of your career. You said that he talked about tennis and approached tennis in a way that you had never experienced before. Can you give us an example of one of those things or one of the ways that he tried to shape your tennis that was unusual to you?
Because I think he approached tennis in a way, in a tactical way, that I'd never experienced or approached it myself. And so he was analyzing the game for me and with me. So I would analyze my own game, but I also would analyze my opponent's games with him. And he would talk about tennis in this, in tactical aspect. So ball placement, the placement and approach to a ball of myself, the position I would have on the court, but also in my chair, in combination with, for example, a serve. And he would like lay it out as a puzzle, and he would connect all those pieces, and it would turn out eventually in winning a point, basically. Laying it out as a puzzle was new for me, or was not a technique that I used before. And I think in a tactic way, it's maybe a very confusing way that I'm sharing it with you is maybe confusing, but also I would say in wheelchair tennis, tactics was not a very much spoken subject yet. Mm. And tactics in combination with what disability you have and what possibilities you have in a chair is a combination that was not spoken about. So he said, whenever you return a point, your recovery is one of the weakest points in wheelchair tennis. So you have to make the point short to keep control. And then, he would just tell me to each opponent, he would tell me where to place the ball in return. where to position myself in recovery, and then had only one or two shots in advance to make it, to make sure that the point is short, and then have control over yourself and your opponent. It's a confusing story, but...
Well, what sticks out to me, though, is that that was a trailblazing moment in itself, because perhaps the way that you played or the way that you were coached opened the door to other wheelchair tennis players to place a priority on that side of things.
Exactly.
And I read the story about how you approached Sven about coaching you, and of course he's quite a well-known coach. I think most people know him for coaching Maria Sharapova. Was that one of the most nervous moments of your career?
Yes.
You tell that story.
Oh yeah, well I just had won my gold medal in Beijing 2008, and I was thinking over, where do I want to go with my career? Do I want to take this next step? Do I still want to continue playing? Or do I want to, step down? And then I realized, I need some new input. I need some new fresh energy in my training routine. And I wanted to switch coaches, because the one that I already worked with for 10 years. Mm-hmm. I wanted to switch coaches, and then the big question was, who am I going to ask? Because who is an expert in wheelchair tennis and who's not? Well, there's not a lot of tennis coaches that are experts in wheelchair tennis. And then I thought, well, maybe I do not need an expert in wheelchair tennis. I just need an expert in tennis. And Sven is Dutch as well. And of course, coached a lot of stars. And just, I wanted to pop the question to Sven. asking if he wanted to coach me, but I realized that he had no experience with this disability sport, with wheelchair tennis. He's one of the biggest coaches out there. And I was a little bit of, ashamed maybe asking him, to coach a wheelchair tennis player where there's no, there's not a lot of fame, or there's not a lot of big shows, there's not a lot of glitter or glamour, around the wheelchair tennis tour. There's not a lot of money I can offer him. I just didn't know how to ask the question. And so together with the national coach of the Netherlands, I went up to him and asked him if he would like to, or he was able to help me. And then his reaction is just priceless. He said, he was honored that I asked him. And he said, this is going to widen or deepen my horizon as a coach, and I have worked with the most perfect bodies on the planet, and it's kind of easy to teach the perfect bodies how to hit a forehand, right? But now you're asking me to teach a wheelchair tennis player, which I don't have any knowledge about wheelchairs and disabilities, and your body doesn't function as a normal body, so I don't know what I can teach you or what you're limited to. But this is going to help me as a coach, as a human being, and as my skills as a coach. And the way that he said that, and I think that is priceless. And that's also why I think he is one of the best coaches out there. He was vulnerable at the time. He was open to learn. And that's why, I think we connected really good. Yeah.
That gives me the chills, actually. That is a really neat moment. And was that something that you look back on? You said that you felt initially ashamed approaching him.
Mm-hmm.
Did that maybe change how you thought about interactions or putting yourself in vulnerable situations going forward?
Well, I think this helped me putting wheelchair tennis more in the spotlights than I did before, because he also said and told me that it's important to showcase what it is and to show the world and to tell about it and to share it with the people that love tennis, but also just the world, to see what wheelchair tennis is about. And so I think it helped me. It gave me confidence to step forward and talk about it more, and put myself more forward as an athlete, but also the sport as a whole. Yeah.
I want to ask you something, Esther, that, again, perhaps I should have put this earlier in the podcast, but something that able-bodied tennis players maybe don't think about are the particular physical challenges that you had to deal with as a wheelchair tennis player. Can you tell us just a little bit about that? Just anything that obviously you're on the court in a wheelchair, that's a challenge in itself. Mm-hmm. But physically, just in terms of keeping your body in good shape.
Yeah, I think the parts that has been challenging for me was, for example, how to get my body fit. And there wasn't a lot of expertise in nutrition, for example, as a wheelchair tennis player, because you don't use the half of your body. And how do you get fit if it comes to nutrition, but also comes to conditional training, or how do you become strong as an athlete, but don't overtrain yourself, don't overtrain your upper body, because you can't really give it a rest, basically. So the balance between work and rest was challenging. And I think, you know, sitting is not a very good position for a human being. So sitting and play sports and play the highest level of sports is very stressful for your body and your lower back. And I think that's one of the weakest points for wheelchair tennis players, is that your lower back is, there's a lot of tension on that.
You've talked a few times today about how you didn't have anyone necessarily to look at and say, that's what I want to be. And you have provided that for so many athletes, wheelchair tennis players, potential Olympians, that you have your foundation, which is, I know, does incredible work. I look at Dita de Groot, of course, and she's Dutch as well. When you think about your impact and your legacy, how meaningful is that to you?
It means a lot to me. I think it's the biggest compliment you can get. If other people tell you that they have you as an example, or because of you, because I helped them, you know, pick a sport or pick tennis as a sport, and also maybe that I helped them or to to flatten the path for them. Mm-hmm. in wheelchair tennis. And so it's a compliment, and I'm honored that I have that position. And I also realize that there is a responsibility that you have as an athlete, which is sometimes hard or heavy or stressful, or but at the other hand, I don't think there's anything more beautiful than that role and that position. So yeah, I cherish that.
Yeah, and to get on to maybe being able to put more of your time into your foundation, you had to eventually decide to retire. And you did that on a 470 match winning streak. Not many people get to retire at the top. You did that. How did you make the decision? I think it would, to all of us, maybe, and maybe some of the people listening, it would be maybe hard to stop if things were going well.
Oh, yeah, it was. It was probably one of the hardest decisions I'd ever make. I came home from London Paralympics 2012. I sat on my couch together with my boyfriend and just make this summary of my career, but also looking forward, what do I want to do? And where am I at as a person? And what are the years to come? Where do I want to put my energy in? And then, yeah, you're going to make a list of pros and cons. And
did you have an actual pro and con list?
I did. And it changed a lot during those months, because then it's also a very scary time, because I've been playing wheelchair tennis for, I don't know, 19 years, and that's everything I did. And that's, you know, all the people that I know are from wheelchair tennis or the sports world. And now I'm maybe going to enter a new world. And where are my talents there? What can I do? What do I like? Will I ever get the same feeling and feel of joy in something else I'm going to do? And all those question marks, mm-hmm. That's just scary. And leaving a world that you know so well, and that's comfort. So stepping out into another world was just scary. But at the same time, very challenging, and it made me curious. And I also realized that, you know, I was 31 at that time. I have a whole career path in front of me, and I could use the fact that I had a winning streak and just won a gold medal for the benefits of my next career. And so, yeah, that was the time that I thought, well, this is just a moment of me retiring, step back. But I had a couple of times I doubted after that, like, do I want to make a comeback? Did I stop too early?
What drove those feelings? Was it maybe seeing something on TV or wanting to go out and train? What made you potentially want to make those comebacks?
Well, first of all, the routine and the life that you're living as an athlete, and a very structured life, and that's nice. I mean, that you know how much hours of training you have that week, or what you can and cannot eat, or when you're home and when you're gone. It's all very structured,
right.
And I missed the structure. Of course, when seeing matches on television and seeing wheelchair tennis develop as well. I mean, I never had the chance on playing Wimbledon in singles, so there were only a doubles event for wheelchair tennis when I was playing. And so in 2016, there was a first singles event. And I'm like, oh God, that's not on my list yet. Should I make a comeback just for that?
Right.
So yeah, those kind of things would trigger me and would maybe make me doubt a little bit. But never had the intention on, you know, getting back in the track of an athlete and having your life, your whole life, mm-hmm. focused on tennis. And you know, now I'm a mom and I've a great job in sports, and so I don't want to go back now anymore. But I've just, yeah, it's, you know, a different life and different focus points and aspects.
I want to talk about you being a mom in just a moment, but you also had a cancer battle in 2020, and I know there were several months of treatment that you had to go through. How helpful was your experience as an athlete in making your way through that?
Very helpful,
really tough
I think.
Time? Yeah.
Yeah. And of course, it's something that I think and I feel that it was helpful. But the way that I approached being sick and having to battle cancer was something that looked like a tough training schedule. I mean, there's a goal that I wanted to reach, and in tennis, this was a gold medal or number one, and in this situation, it was to battle the illness, and I wanted to get better. And the things that I needed to do for that was having those treatments, having those mm-hmm. chemotherapy, and I just would cross off every single time I had one of those treatments, and realizing that I would be a little bit closer to my goal. Mm-hmm. And that was helpful. And because in the situation that you are sick, there's this feeling that I hate, is that you don't have any control over that situation. So you kind of have to put your trust into the experts, into the doctors, and then just wait basically until you're better. And then, and so the feeling of having a little bit of control by going into this situation just like an athlete just gave me the feeling of control again. Yeah.
Sure. And what has being a mom like? You've done so many things in your life, Esther. You've been retired now for 10 years, but in that time, foundation, a book, you had your experience with cancer, and you have a child.
Yeah.
Can you tell us about that part of your life?
Yeah, and a very, also very complicated part that was, because we really wanted to have a child, but the doctors told me that I couldn't carry a baby myself. So then there's this, yeah, sort of setback in emotional way, and then you're trying to see what solutions are there. Is this adoption, or is this surrogacy, or is this what other options are there? Well, there's not many, and so eventually, and it took us 7 years basically, which is maybe the most emotional and the hardest fight I'd ever had to fight. But it took us 7 years, and eventually we found a Canadian surrogacy mom, and she carried our baby. So genetically, it's ours. So in 2019, we went to Canada and got her. Yeah, well, it's the most wonderful, most intense, most precious moment in life, probably. And well, I mean, she's here with me. She's only 3 and a half now. But to show her around and to have her with me, yeah, I love being a mom, and I love the fact that I can combine my work with motherhood and be home as well. And I never thought of myself, you know, enjoying being home so much, but it's just I love it. Yeah,
is she like you, do you think, personality-wise?
Well, of course, she's a little bit of both. Yes. But she is, she's very stubborn, and I'm very stubborn. And
that helped you, though, right?
Yeah, exactly. Run. It's not a bad thing. And she's very fanatic. Is that how you say it? She's very, if she wants something, then she goes for it. So
yeah,
she's
persistent, yeah.
Yeah, and so I like to see that in her. Yeah, it's nice. And I don't know where it's going to go. I mean,
sure.
She's still young, but yeah.
Well, fantastic that she's here with us in Newport this weekend. And that's what I want to finish talking about with you. Again, you've only just arrived, but you had your tour through the museum. I've heard that there are photos of you coming in through the front doors and just the look on your face, because it is such a special place. What has it been like so far?
Impressive, overwhelming. Never realized before how big this is. It's an honor to be inducted, but to realize what tennis is and the history of tennis and the development of so many things. It's the tennis balls, it's the records, it's the clothing, it's the equipment, it's the personalities. It's a wonderful and beautiful sport. And once you walk into the museum, you realize that it's amazing what the development has been, and that I am part of that is unbelievable. I'm struck by all those things.
Well, listen, I feel like we could be here all day asking you questions. I know that I certainly could, and we appreciate you being with us on the Tennis Worthy podcast.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for being here.
Thanks.
Wasn't that an incredibly moving interview? Esther Vergeer talking with Blair Henley. And she makes a point in her final answer that's worth emphasizing to all tennis fans. The Tennis Worthy podcast is listened to around the world, but if you're ever in the northeast of the United States, whether on vacation or business, do see if you can plan a trip to see the International Tennis Hall of Fame in person. Rhode Island may be one of the smallest states in the U.S., but it's beautiful, and picturesque Newport is the principal city, and the Hall of Fame is a remarkable center celebrating the history of tennis. Well worth a visit if you can. And Esther Vergeer, of course, will always have a place as one of its legends, not just in wheelchair tennis, but tennis in general. Our next podcast features another immensely likable female competitor, the former U.S. Open and Australian Open champion and Fed Cup winner, Kim Clijsters. Join us for that via your preferred podcast platform or by going to tennisfame.com/podcast, where you can find all the interviews we've posted so far. This is already the 14th. The Tennis Worthy podcast is brought to you by the International Tennis Hall of Fame in association with the Tennis Radio Network. I'm Brett Haber. Thanks so much for listening. And don't forget to tell your friends about these interviews. We look forward to your company next time.